most people are not going to know Paris well enough to know, like, hey, the building on that corner is 4 stories in the real Paris, but it's only 3 stories in this Paris.
This is Up, Up, Down, Down, the show about the art and craft of video games. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, a 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment, later Activision. He's now co-founder of Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
Also joining us today is Noel Berry.
Hey.
Having made countless indie games, Noel is now a programmer and designer of the upcoming procedural platformer Skytorn. And we're super excited to be talking about this today because our topic is procedural generation and procedural content in games. So this is something that I understand kind of like going through some of the work that you've done, Noel, that you've been working on this for a while. But you want to tell us a little bit about Skytorn to kind of get us started? What's that all about?
Yeah, sure. So Skytorn is a procedurally generated adventure game that takes place in the sky on this floating island, and you're this... you play as this girl who's exploring it, and there's kind of these different dungeons and different mysteries and stuff that take place on the island. So you kind of land on the island and you begin exploring it and fight monsters. And it's procedurally generated. So and inspired by games of I guess similar kind of thing. So yeah, you kind of go through this procedurally generated island in the sky, and you can dig and fight monsters and get new power ups and stuff like that.
The digging is something that I definitely enjoyed. So I see that in the art and in the previews for Skytorn that the hero, she has a shovel, which is something in Crypt of the Necrodancer I very much enjoyed, which is another procedurally generated game in out of Vancouver also, actually. And yeah, their main character has a shovel. And so it actually works really, really well with the procedural generation, where you can have a map that's like a little weird sometimes, and like occasionally it'll have kind of quirky aspects to it. But worst case scenario, you just dig your way out.
Yeah, it definitely allows the map to kind of not break necessarily, but the map can kind of be weird, and you can do some stranger things with it, and the player still has the power and the ability to move around and make it through the map, which is really nice and good for procedural games where things aren't always super precise, I guess.
So what was it that sort of inspired you or motivated you to pick procedural generation for the level design? It's definitely something that's been a lot more popular, or at least I've been seeing it a lot more in indie games in recent years. Was there a particular design goal that motivated you to it, or is it something like you played other games that...
Yeah, I've been experimenting with procedural generation a lot, and I'm inspired by a lot of those games. I really like Spelunky and games like that. And so I guess I was inspired by those kind of things, and I've been messing around with them a lot. And Skytorn is just kind of what slowly evolved as I worked on a lot of just sort of prototypes and demos and small games. But it also felt like it would fit well. We wanted to make this world that you could kind of explore and find your way through and find all these kind of cool things as you go through it. And making a procedural world just seemed to make sense for that. And it felt like it would be a lot of fun to have the player kind of explore this world that changes when they play again. It seems to lead well to work well with the digging mechanic. We wanted this world where you could dig and explore in that way too. And it felt like a really cool way to have that all tie together really nicely.
Yeah, I guess I talked a little bit of Crypt of the Necrodancer as like a procedural generated world that you can dig in. And I guess considering the ridiculous popularity of Minecraft, it's funny that that's the game that I think of as first as the procedurally generated world where you can dig in. But it's definitely that. It's also a very fun thing in Minecraft where, you know, there's this just completely crazy, is there an outside bound on how big the worlds are? I'm sure that, I guess they're not arbitrarily large, but the worlds in Minecraft, I imagine, are fairly ludicrously large. But, you know, you could be exploring horizontally, but it's a lot more fun a lot of the time to just, let's just dig this ridiculous hole. And then you just find something that no level designer would ever have created this crazy lava-filled cave that's like 500 feet below some boring desert that nothing is around for 100 miles. But if you find it, it seems really magical.
So. Yeah, you can kind of create these worlds that go on a lot further.
I think the levels in Minecraft, in theory, are supposed to be infinitely large. Like that the intent was for them to be infinitely large, but that in practice you can't go arbitrarily far in them because of like floating point precision issues and stuff like that, that right. too far away from the origin, it doesn't hold together anymore. But
I've heard about this. So this is like the fact that computers obviously don't, maybe not obviously, don't represent non-even numbers, like decimal numbers don't get estimated exactly. And so eventually when your world is so far away that it starts to approach whatever it is, 2,147,000,000 cubes away. And isn't someone like trying to venture like out off the edge of the thing?
I think we talked about that once before, but there's a guy like trying to walk off the edge of the world essentially. But one thing about Minecraft that's, you know, that sort of cuts against that is it's infinite in like surface area, but it's very finite in height, right? Like you can always in any given spot dig to the bottom of the world in that area fairly easily, which is you know, which is sort of interesting that they don't, you know, they don't go infinite. They only go infinite in two of the three directions that you can go in.
Is that then maybe, I'm not sure if you guys would know, but do they like just basically have a seed value, and that anytime the game wants to generate, like when you're, are you walking, is it generating as you walk? Is it generating, is it even generating, or is it really just there's some algorithm that determines where things are based on a seed value and it doesn't actually store them?
You set a seed value for the world and you can actually pick it yourself. Like you can actually type in the seed when you're generating the world. So you can recreate the same world from the seed value if you want. And then that defines basically what every single chunk in the world will look like as you, you know, as you sort of move through it. And so it doesn't actually pre-generate, like it only pre-generates some number of chunks around you, but then given just the one seed value, all ones that are farther away, you know, sort of have a defined way that they're going to get generated. And as you walk there, it'll generate them.
I guess one thing it could do too is it could make the world loop if you reach the end of that finite integer value or float value. So you could, like, I guess make it wrap or something like that in the game like Minecraft.
That would be kind of disappointing. Some guy spends like years wandering to the edge of the world. Although, would he even notice if it wrapped? Because he would get
he
to
probably wouldn't notice for quite a while.
Yeah. If he was going in a straight line, he would have to go that distance again to get from the far edge then back to the center again.
Yeah, and you'd have to go in a perfectly straight line, right? Like if you just got a little bit off, you could easily miss your starting point and you know, be very close to your starting point, but not realize that you're that close.
Yeah.
The more I think about this, though, this is weird. So the game is like arbitrarily large based on a seed value. It only generates the space around you, but like as you're walking, does that mean it's generating as you're walking and storing it, or does it only store the changes you make?
It stores, I'm pretty sure it stores the map, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, I think it stores the whole generated map. I'm not 100% sure, but I believe the longer you've played and the more you've explored, the bigger your save file gets basically, and it stores each chunk that's ever been generated in its entirety. There's some elements that I don't, like I think there's some of the things like the, you know, like the placement algorithms for some of the buildings and stuff like that that have also changed slightly. So you won't get, like, as you upgrade to like a new version, you won't get exactly the same layout of some of the stuff. Like, I think the terrain generation is the same every time, but as they've added like new structures and stuff like that, some of those structures will appear in newly generated chunks, but not in old chunks and stuff like that.
Oh, that's actually a pretty good solution to that problem, right?
Yeah, that makes sense.
So what is the procedural generation algorithms that you've been working on look like now? Is there a particular procedure or tactic that you found makes good levels?
For Skytorn specifically, what we've been doing a lot is we don't fully, like, it is procedural, but it has designed elements. So we actually design, like, hand-designed rooms, and then, or we call them chunks because rooms are built out of multiple chunks, but we build these chunks, and then the whole map is built, is generated out of these chunks. So we kind of figure out where things will be in the map through an algorithm, like, oh, here's this, a room is going to be here, a tunnel is going to be here, the surface of the island is going to be here, and we figure that out through an algorithm, and then we place chunks in the context of each of those areas. So this is a tunnel chunk that, you know, connects here, and they're like hand designed with some randomness added to them. So we'll have these rooms and things like that that are built out of multiple chunks that we've designed, and then it kind of creates this interesting feel where it the rooms feel, or the areas, the whole map feels more designed than it actually is, but it's actually very random. And we randomized some of the elements inside each chunk as well, and like what enemies and what items and objects get spawned there as well. But the actual like collisions and terrain layers and stuff are hand designed and then placed all over the place randomly with these given the correct context, and that makes the world feel, it gives really interesting rooms and a really interesting feel, because it feels like things are very purposely placed, but they're still very random.
That's very cool. I feel like sort of there's a big range from the really, really random games. Like if you ever played Diablo 1, which is, or Diablo 2, some early sort of early modern roguelikes, where it really did feel random to the point where they would just generate this long end, like you could start like one of the levels and you could pick the left side or the right side. You pick the right side and you go and go and go and go, and it's like twisting in on itself and twisting in itself, and eventually it becomes this super long dead end. And you go the other way, and it's like, right. Oh, actually, the warp to the next level is just like 5 feet from if I had turned left instead of right. And so it doesn't feel designed at all. It feels very arbitrary. And then contrast that to Diablo 3, where they wanted it to like never frustrate the player. And so it ended up being so minimally random that it didn't feel random at all. It just felt like designed, and you would play the same level twice. And then even though it was different, it was not different in a way that it felt like it was different, if that makes any sense. Right. Like you wouldn't necessarily remember, yeah. Oh, yeah, it's over to the left, but you almost felt like you did remember it, and you almost felt like you were playing it by memory, even though it was switched up in a certain way. So there's like that continuum, and of course people complain because that's what they do when you rev a game and change anything about it. There's no dumb dead ends.
Yeah, I guess that is definitely a fine line to walk along when you're making procedural games. Like how designed do you make it versus how random do you make it? And I think it depends on the kind of game you're making too, I guess. It's really interesting. Going one way or the other too much can lead to interesting things.
Yeah, I think the approach that Spelunky took, for anyone who hasn't played, it's a 2D procedurally generated sort of platformy game. It's fairly like lighthearted and cartoony and stuff like that. And in some ways, or at least from what I've seen, helped kind of kick off the modern wave of procedural platformers that we've been seeing. But even when you're playing through the game, because each level is pretty short and it is all about the same width and all about the same height, and they kind of, you pretty much just play level one, play level two, play level three, and like it's still, even though within the levels they're different each time, it still definitely feels like you're on a designed track. And then just like each little blob is generated, which is obviously incredibly different from something like Minecraft. And even from what I've seen from SkyTurn, like it seems like, and maybe this changes over time, but it seems like the levels are a bit larger than the Spelunky levels. Is that the case?
Yeah, SkyTurn is kind of like, yeah, SkyTurn is more like one world you're exploring, rather than Spelunky is like, here's a level that's being procedurally generated. When you complete that level, you go on to the next level. So there's a like a specific starting at the top and a specific ending at the bottom, and you go through and you find the door. SkyTurn is more, it's a more open world than that. So I guess it's more similar to Minecraft in some ways, minus the whole crafting and building and all that kind of thing. You're kind of just exploring one larger world rather than progressing through a set of levels.
Yeah, which definitely feels fun to me, like when you're discovering a world that, you know, has never existed except for you, you know, and similar to something like Minecraft. Or even if you look at a game like Civilization, where, you know, when the game starts, it generates this huge map and you're somewhere on it and your enemies are in various places, and the story that effectively comes out when you play a game of Civilization depends on the randomly generated map that it makes for you. If your first neighbor is super violent and gonna like start attacking you, then you might turn into like a more militaristic strategy, and if your first neighbor is friendly, then that might change the way the whole game goes just based on that seed value that it chose when it generated the map.
There's something kind of beautiful about some of the like levels that get created in Minecraft, partially knowing that they're procedurally generated, that, you know, when you see some really impressive vista in a more conventional, you know, fully designed game, it's like, okay, yeah, that's nice, but it's just like a bunch of artists sat down and made that. So like, big whoop, we know artists are good at art. Whereas there's something kind of charming about, you know, discovering some really cool looking structure, some really amazing vista in something like Minecraft, because you know that it's random, that it's just kind of a fluke, and that there's a good chance that no one else has ever seen that thing before, because, you know, unless you're playing off a seed that someone else gave you, the chances of, you know, two users randomly getting the same seed is pretty low. So yeah, there's definitely some like real discovery and excitement factor in having that big world that's you know, nothing in it has ever really been seen before.
And it feels sort of like when you're in nature, right?
Yeah, it makes a really cool world that you can explore. And I definitely agree with the part that you said where, you know, no one else has really seen it before. It's like you are discovering this thing and you are finding it. And that, I mean, that's a really awesome feeling, because it just makes it feel like you're really going through this really interesting world that has been, you know, you just kind of fell into this place and you're exploring it. And that's a really cool feeling that you don't get from, you can get it from non-procedural games, but I think it's harder to make that feeling.
And it's harder to keep that feeling going over the lifetime of playing the game, right? Like a game might feel really inventive and fresh the first time through it, but the second time through, you know, a lot of that stuff is not going to be as fresh. Even if there's, you know, even if there's elements where things are getting mixed up, it's not, you know, you start to see the cracks a bit the second time through with a game that's designed for things to feel really spontaneous and cool. And whereas with Minecraft, it is really spontaneous every time. So every time you start it off, you're going to get a whole different, at least a whole different initial experience, right? In terms of where you're starting and what biomes are around you and stuff like that.
So this general approach of procedural generation has become a lot more popular in indie games over the last few years, but still, I wouldn't say, at least I've noticed it get more popular, and in some ways maybe it's even almost less popular in AAA games than it maybe has been, with things like Diablo moving away from being more random and to being a little more designed in its levels. What do you guys think is the sort of driver of why it's more used and more popular in indie games than AAA games?
So I think one reason that it's that a lot of independent developers are doing is just that it's a little bit easier to prototype these things very fast, and you don't have to build a ton of levels to kind of get the feeling going. You can kind of you can kind of just mess around with it and make these little weird worlds pretty quickly if you kind of can get a little algorithm running fast and figure out how to spawn things. And I think it gives a really cool feeling for independent developers, because you can kind of build these worlds a bit more quickly, and you can keep trying it over and over again yourself as you're testing new stuff. Whereas when you are designing, you know, large levels, you have to test new mechanics. You have to design a lot of new levels before you can, I don't know, start feeling them as much. And it doesn't work for certain kinds of games either, obviously. But for games that are built to be more procedural, I think it's pretty easy for like one or two programmers to make that happen really quickly. And test it out and stuff like that.
There's a split between fully designing stuff and having procedural stuff in terms of, you know, how fast you can get to the quality content, right? That, yeah, a designed level is going to be able to be good in a way that a procedurally generated level isn't, because you have, you know, a huge amount of latitude to control the exact experience that the player's getting, but it takes a huge amount of effort to get to that point, right? It's lots of iteration and lots of different people looking at the levels and trying it with different playtesters and stuff like that. And, you know, an indie team just isn't going to have the resources probably to polish it. Whereas something like procedural generation, like you can get, you know, 70% of the way to the quality of a fully designed level, but you can do it in like a tenth the effort. You know, that's obviously huge if you're, you know, if this is something you're doing in your spare time, or that you have a, you know, the minimal budget that you've managed to scrape together on Kickstarter or something like that. Like it's, you know, it's a huge, in the same way that some of the other things that we've talked about, the choices that indie games make of like, you know, using something like Unity or picking an art style that's 8-bit instead of full 3D. Like there's so many of those choices that are, that it's just kind of impractical to make the other choice sometimes. You know, obviously it's not that indie games can't have well-designed content, but if you're going to have well-designed content, it's either going to take you a long time to put the game together, or it's going to have a really short game. Whereas with the procedural content, you can say, we just keep iterating on this one procedural generation thing. And once we've got that locked down, now we've got as much content as we want. And we don't have to hire an artist or a bunch of level designers to sit and make those things. And yeah, maybe it's not going to be quite to the same quality level as if you'd taken those same mechanics and designed a bunch of levels for it. But you just can't give up on the practical advantages of not having to have all those people making the game, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Procedural levels will never be quite as good as hand design levels. Like, there's no way you can actually ever do that. So yeah, I think it's just more like you can just build more content faster and have more of a game with procedural levels than you could if you had to design them all. Cause yeah, I think you're right. Just the length of the game. It's a lot harder to build that many levels and make a really long game. When you only have a small team. So your game will either be shorter with a bunch of really cool levels, or you can do procedural stuff, which can make it a bit of a longer game for sure.
I think the point is really interesting that you can actually iterate as an indie team on some of the game design and mechanics stuff a lot faster when you have that procedural generation. You know, if you're coming into a AAA game and it's like, all right, this is going to be Nathan Drake and he's going to shoot stuff in these ways and this is what's going to happen. And then you can just have this army of people developing all the content, that's fine. But if you're like, hey, wouldn't it be cool if you could have a game where this crazy things happens that like you can dig or that like you can light parts of the level on fire and see what happens, and then needing to actually build out test levels for that to even be able to try those things out when you're a team that's like one or two people and it's like, you know, an artist and a developer or something like that, it would mean that you're basically constrained. As soon as you start building out levels, then you pretty much can't change the game design that much because it's just too expensive to have to recreate them all. And so I think that's a really cool thing about generating.
Even just from the standpoint of, you know, it makes it easier to use yourself as a guinea pig for some of those things. Like, one of the big problems in game development is getting the blinders on and like not, you know, you don't really understand what's working or what isn't working in the game anymore because you've seen this stuff so many times and the game's kind of trained you to play it the best that you can with the current set of stuff. You know, or you'll know where all the shortcuts is or how to get by the bits that you've seen all this level content before. I mean, that, you know, procedural content doesn't make that problem go away, but it removes a certain aspect of it, which is that every time you play, you're seeing a level that you've never seen before. So, okay, maybe you're getting a little jaded on the mechanics of gameplay, but at least the content is new to you. And I think that keeps it that you can be a reasonable stand-in for the audience longer than you can get away with a game with a very polished level design, but where all the people that are working on the team have seen all those levels hundreds of times and just can't tell what's working, particularly what's working for someone who's seeing a level new for the first time anymore.
Yeah, when you're building a procedural game, you can be playing it the 27th time, and this amazingly cool thing would happen that you never intended to be possible, and then be like, wow, okay, that I need to make that happen more now, because there was this weird, crazy thing where, you know, there was this creature at this exact time or on this piece or whatever, and it made this really cool, fun, interesting consequence. And so you basically are getting all these sort of new ideas being thrown at you just by the random seed, which is very cool.
Yeah, and yeah, like you said earlier, Nigel, you still get the issue of the mechanics part for sure. Like, you don't know if, oh, does a combat thing actually still make sense? Because it feels good, but who knows if people will actually understand it. You still have all that in procedural games, obviously, but just it definitely makes it last longer because you can just seeing new things over and over again. Yeah.
So a common problem with procedural levels and procedural games in general is this issue that it's hard to make it so that you're sure that the users aren't going to end up in an unfairly hard situation. And this is something that, you know, a lot of games have struggled with in like varying degrees of success that have procedural generation. But one of the ones that we actually had on the show when we're talking about was Dan Cook, his most recent game, Road Not Taken, which was a very cool game and very interesting sort of aesthetic and stuff like that. It was like a story that went through these procedurally generated puzzles, basically. And it had really incredibly high replayability, way more than the small size of team would be able to create. But the thing that they suffered under was that when the game was very, very first coming out and then suddenly being played by a much larger number of people, the reviews ended up being mostly very good, but occasionally a review would be like, yeah, this game is really good, but this one level was just way too unfairly hard, and I just got totally destroyed by it, and I was upset or something, because it's just so random that you can never have played every single possible combination of these puzzles. And so since then, they've sort of iterated it and improved that and reduced the chances of certain bad combinations happening. But that's, I think, an interesting challenge with the historical way the games have fixed that or dealt with that problem is with this like idea of the roguelikes where you're supposed to die. You know, that's kind of embracing. It's like, well, sometimes it's going to be impossible and you're just going to die. So that's just part of the game.
And it depends on the kind of game, too. Like games like Splunky or Rogue Legacy kind of, I guess, work with that problem by just making the game harder as you go. And they won't spawn harder enemies or things like that that will, like, you know, potentially stop you or make it way harder until you get to those further parts. A puzzle game and stuff like that, or games that have a lot more puzzle elements that are random, kind of like Rogue Untaken, just has, you know, I guess it has more chance of a puzzle being way harder just by accident almost. You know, Rogue Legacy or Steam or Splunky and stuff couldn't do that quite. They can work around that more easily just because it just can, well, we won't spawn these harder enemies until you're here or whatever, and things like that.
Yeah, that's definitely one advantage of the difficulty being just based on the enemies rather than the environment or by, you know, chance. But you can still, I mean, like Skytron is a platformer, so I imagine there's circumstances where, you know, defeating an enemy who's been placed in one location could be a lot easier if you're like, you know, if you need to jump on his head and you're right above him and you just followed him, then it's easy, as opposed to if you're climbing up out of a hole and he's like moving just at this exact angle, it can be quite hard to avoid, you know, just by bad chance. Or two of them spawn, you know, they're only supposed to spawn in these boxes, but the one spawns on the left edge of his box and the other spawns on the right edge of the box, so they're both kind of in each other's faces and they're in your face, and, you know, you can easily imagine circumstances where. So I don't know, is there anything in your experiences so far that you've seen any of those problems, or is it still sort of, you know, you're pretty good at the game because you're making it, so you're able to overcome?
No, yeah. I mean, I usually am personally, just because, like you said, I played it so much over and over again that I'm pretty good at working on those circumstances. But when we have other people play, you definitely run into the situations where there's some kind of, I guess, weird places that enemies spawned, or a bunch of them spawned one place, or it spawned two hard enemies on top of each other, and then they're way more difficult. But often what happens is that people, like you said, in this kind of game, people will die, and then they'll kind of go and explore a different area and come back to that part later when they've learned more or gotten better. And we make sure it doesn't happen often enough. Like there's stuff we put in place to make sure that, you know, crazy, like it won't spawn like 10 hard enemies on top of each other in one room and make it like impossible. So that will never happen. But it does have harder areas and less hard areas just randomly sometimes. But I think people usually die or like, whoa, that looks hard, and they go away and find other items and fight other stuff and then come back later. Just because since the world is open, they can kind of do that.
I definitely did a lot of that in the Don't Starve game, which is another sort of randomly generated overworld, and you're wandering around trying to survive. And I would go over to an area that wasn't super far from my hometown sometimes. And so it was just more random chance than because I had gotten to a harder part. But it was just like, okay, this is a really dangerous area. I should get the heck out of here because this is bad. I'll come back here when I'm like, you know, I have armor and I'm awesome. Right now, I'm still just this squishy, vulnerable guy. So that's definitely something. If you give people the flexibility to be able to leave and come back, as opposed to something where it's just a linear game, then it's a lot easier to have these, even if it's accidental, these little traps that you can then come back to later.
I think a lot of the roguelike, dying as part of the game as opposed to a failure state does tend to bleed into a lot of procedurally generated games. You know, if you kind of know you're playing the same random level or playing a different random level every time, you're not as worried about like, oh, did I fail because I died? It's just like, well, I didn't make it through that. I mean, there's a, you know, sort of huge section of the procedurally generated games that we haven't really talked about that are all about you're guaranteed to eventually fail, which are like the, you know, the infinite runner or something like that style games, you know, stuff like Cannibalt or Crossy Road has been the big one recently, where you basically just keep going forever with content being procedurally generated, and there is no win condition. There's only a loss condition, right? You can't you know, you can't ever succeed at those games. It's really just seeing how long you can go. And I think, you know, people that at least are savvy consumers of video games always probably let a little bit of that in when they're playing a game that they know is procedurally generated, is that, yeah, there's going to be some, there's going to be some games that are going to be harder than others, and I'm going to die sometime, and that's okay, because dying just means I get a new level to play or something like that, right?
Yeah, it's not like a traditional linear game where when you die, you just go back to your last save and have to try the same thing again. Dying is part of the system, and it's part of the game. It's expected. It's not like, it's not saying, oh, you did that wrong. It's just saying, well, you just didn't make it further that time.
I guess part of the trick then in developing a game like Crossy Road is trying to make it feel like when you die, you died because you made a mistake and not just because you were unlucky and then got an impossible combination. And you want to slowly ramp up that difficulty without ever, occasionally it'll happen, but without every time the person dying, just from being frustrated, we're like, well, I could never possibly have done that because there was an 18 lanes and there was a semi-truck all going all across all lanes, and it's just, you're going to get hit anyway and there's nothing you can do. So,
yeah. Yeah, I think you want to, for procedural games, I think that's true of almost any game, is you want to make sure that the player always feels like it was their fault they died, or that, you know, it wasn't the game being unfair to them in some way. But yeah, definitely true for procedural games that give random stuff to the player.
I think people definitely cut procedural games a little more slack on that, you know, in a more designed game, if you die in some unexpected way, you know, there's a certain of annoyance at like, well, you know, the designer should have explained to me better what I was supposed to do in that situation. Whereas I don't think people, like I said, assuming they know and sort of understand that, yeah, the game content is not the same every time, which probably there are some users that don't get that. But if you get that, I think most people are willing to cut it a little more slack, that they're willing to say, yeah, it's not the game's fault that I didn't know what to do in this crazy situation that I haven't seen before, because the game is not, you know, the game is not set up to try and lead you through it. Whereas getting stuck in the same way in a more conventional game, it feels like a failure of game design, right? That the game designer should have explained to you what you were supposed to do here or lead you better. And you just don't, people don't have that same expectation of games that they know are all procedurally generated or infinite kind of content.
I don't know if we talked much about Crossy Road on the show yet, although it's been discussed on many other podcasts and things like that. But it's, for anyone who hasn't seen it, it's a iOS, it's on Android now is also, but a mobile game that takes a lot of its inspiration from Frogger, but it's more of an infinite Frogger than a one level at a time Frogger. And it has been incredibly popular over the last, two to four weeks that it's been out, making literally millions of dollars. And it's one of those, two or three people have made many games in the past, and their overnight success was not at all overnight. But it's nice to see that they've been doing well based on this game. But I think in the context of what you're saying about making people realize that it's different each time, I think Crossy Road does something, or noticed it doing something, that most of those sort of infinite games don't do, that really makes it clear that it's different each time, which is that the beginning area doesn't always feel the same. So in a lot of games, you'll sort of say like what Spelunky does, which is the first level, or Necrodancer, almost all procedurally generated games I've played, the first level is like uses this tile set and it has these enemies and these quantities, and like really makes sure that the first level kind of just feels like the first level. And then when you get to the 10th level, then this happens. When you get to the 20th level, this happens. Whereas with Crossy Road, sometimes you'll start and there'll be like three lanes of traffic in front of you. And then sometimes you'll start and there'll be trains already, which is like one of the things that are, they move faster. And so I sort of perceive them as a higher level obstacle, but sometimes there's one like immediately, it's the very first tile that you see. And sometimes it'll be just like five layers of grass. So like the very, very first screen that you see often looks totally different. And so I think 99% of people are going to pick up after playing three or four rounds that, oh, okay, each time this is just a totally different thing. It's not. Whereas you could imagine playing Cannibalt, which every time it starts with you in a building and then you run and then you jump out the window and then you go. You can imagine someone playing Cannibalt 5, 10, 20 times who's not very perceptive of game design and thinking it actually was the same each time. So I think that's, and then that means that they can get away then with more, they know people knowing that it's different each time can be like, oh, that was a really hard one. Or like, oh, this was a particularly awesome one. And sort of enjoying that part of the game design.
Yeah, definitely.
Cannibal is also a really interesting example of like using the procedural content generation to add breadth, right? Because when they release Cannibal 2 as like a free update, one of the main things in it is that they've got, you know, I think it's 8 or something different levels that are all basically just leaning on one of the obstacles being way more frequent than it is in the real game, right? So you'll have like you'll have like one that's got a whole bunch of crumbling buildings, or you'll have one that has a whole bunch of the little bombs that drop down and, unexpectedly. And you'll have one that has a whole bunch of other windows that you have to jump into. And it's basically just like, you know, I don't think they really changed any of the fundamental gameplay at all in the update. It's more just, here's a bunch of other kinds of levels that we can generate from, from the same basic toolbox that we were using to generate the main levels.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing about procedural generation, is you can kind of just tweak the values and mess with things, and then you can have a whole different experience than what you had before, which also, I guess, caters to small teams being able to test and try things very fast as well.
So on this sort of topic of small teams generating large worlds, how much have either of you guys seen about No Man's Sky?
I've watched all of the various promotional videos and stuff of it. It looks pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been following it a little bit. It does look really cool.
It definitely looks really cool, but it's one of those, like, I'm concerned they've bitten off more than they can chew. Like, I think it's like maybe 6 people on the team, and they're like, oh yeah, this world, you can explore the entire galaxy, and like no 2 planets are the same, and no 2 people will ever have the same experience. There's more than 18 quintillion possible combinations. And you're like, well, how many of those 18 quintillion combinations are going to be fun? I'm worried.
Or very different. I think the game, I think it has enough going for it, it'll be really cool, but I'm not sure if it'll, you know, be quite as crazy random and different as people are expecting it to be. But I think, I think for a team, it is hard to make that much be very different every single time you play. Like, it'll be different, and as you explore the worlds and fly through this space and stuff and see different things, it'll be different. But I'm not sure if it'll be like, you know, this crazy, completely different thing that, on every world that people are sort of seem to be expecting. From what I've seen, like the animals and stuff, they kind of build one model and then they tweak random values on the model, so it changes how it looks a little bit. But it's not like a whole new creature every time. It's just a creature that looks slightly different depending on where it spawned and stuff like that.
It's also a little bit difficult to tell, you know, if like in a procedural world like that, where you're generating this enormous world and there's, you know, it seems like there's not much gameplay in big chunks of the world. And that's the stuff they're showing off right now, is like, yo, you're flying around, you're landing on this planet and stuff like that. It's a little difficult to tell from that how well it's going to play, because I'm not sure that you're seeing the actual gameplay mechanics. Like with something like Minecraft, the thing that makes it interesting is not the procedurally generated worlds, right? Like you could generate promo videos for Minecraft that would make it look quite dull in some respects, right? But a lot of the stuff about Minecraft that makes it a good game from an ongoing standpoint is like, okay, you've got this kind of crafting tree that you need to follow, and you know, in certain situations, you know, enemies are going to get more frequent, and you're going to, you know, you craft this one thing and you can go to the nether dimension, and then things are even more complicated and difficult there. And it, you know, in some ways that stuff, like figuring out what you need to craft to advance through the game to get through the various milestones, like that's the actual gameplay portion of Minecraft. And we haven't seen that really with No Man's Sky yet. Like, I don't feel like I have a good handle from the stuff I've seen on, like, what are you doing minute to minute in gameplay? What they're showing off is all the cool, like, hey, you're flying around between all these planets, and all these planets look really cool. And then, okay, once you get on the planet and you need to, like, craft something to survive on that planet, what does that gameplay look like? And, it could be that gameplay is not good enough to not make things feel kind of boring and samey, but we just don't know yet. We haven't gotten enough information.
Yeah, it's definitely hard to tell. Yeah, from a distance, all the planets look really cool, but it'll be interesting to see, like, as you go closer into detail on them and, like, yeah, the specifics, that'll be interesting.
I think I've just been a little jaded from, although it was quite some time ago now, Spore, which was that game, like, anything can happen, and, like, it's infinite from, you know, cellular level to the universe. When you actually play it, you're like, okay, well, you know, then you sort of, in retrospect, are like, of course it's not like it's every single thing you're always doing is incredibly fun. Like, if it has all the things, then each thing is going to be, you know, necessarily less fun. So, but I'm definitely very curious. I will likely play it anyway, even despite my, you know, because it's one of those games that will probably be, you know, either a very interesting success or an interesting failure. So I'm kind of curious to see where you kind of put that.
I'm excited to see how it progresses and what comes out of it for sure.
Another game that sort of has been in a lot of discussion because of its procedural generation is an actual one of the few AAA games that actually is experimenting with this in ways that are sort of new and novel, which is The Shadows of Mordor, which we've talked a fair bit about in a few episodes ago. Our episode talking about Caragors, I think, was the title. But have you played it, Noel?
I played it a little bit. I haven't. I was with some friends. And we just played it for maybe 2 or 3 hours, but I haven't seen a lot of it yet.
Yeah, so it's, you know, in a lot of ways it's a typical game in the style of Arkham Asylum or maybe Assassin's Creed, where you're running around being awesome and killing things. But the thing that's procedurally interesting about it is that your enemies, and not just like, you know, the creatures that you see that are the trash mobs, like just things that you need to kill, but more interestingly, like your nemesis and the so sort of bosses that you're fighting are also procedurally generated. So they've procedurally generated names and procedurally generated faces and procedurally generated traits and attributes and weaknesses and strengths. And you play when you play the game long enough, or at least as long as I did, then you start to see like reused, like it's not that they completely generate the face out of nowhere. It's like one of 20 faces and then one of 20 built body shapes and one of 20 voices, and you start to see them, they start to repeat to some degree. But it's still like, especially for the first game that's kind of doing this to this degree, it's quite successful at making you feel like you're in this organic world where whenever you go to, you know, take out the leader of one of these enemy cells, that someone else, you know, rises up to become the leader of it, and it's some new character, and they have this basically infinite depth of characters. And that's then not being used in the way that procedural generation is used in some games, just to make it so it's different every time you play. It's more so that, you know, there's a gameplay element that they don't need to constrain you in, that you can, you know, kill as many of these leaders, and that, you know, new ones will take their ranks, as opposed to, you know, most of the time procedural generation, although I guess there are definitely exceptions to it, procedural generation of levels that I've seen often is not done to make the game infinitely long. It's done to make it different each time you play, right?
Yeah. I like the idea of using small amounts of randomization and procedural generation for like very specific things like that. It just adds an interesting sort of detail to the world and makes it, I think it makes it feel really interesting, just having small amounts of it here and there. Even if the entire game isn't a procedural game, just having these small elements or small things like that that change how the game feels, I think that's really cool.
There's also the matter with that they've, to some degree, I think they're sort of forced into a scenario like that by some of the concept of that game, with saying, all right, well, we're going to integrate the player's death into it, right? Which is something that most games don't do. Like in most games, your death is, you know, either you rewind to the last checkpoint, or maybe if you've got some, you know, infinite procedurally generated style games, like we've talked about, you just start over from the beginning. But with this, it's like, okay, the player's death is going to be integrated into the narrative, in that the player's death benefits the person that killed the player. And like, once you've made that choice, you can't entirely build that stuff in advance, because you can't control how good the player is going to be, right? So you can't say, okay, well, this particular chieftain is going to kill the player, and so then he's going to be like the big boss when you get to the next section because he advanced because he killed the player. Like, there's no way you could build conventionally scripted narrative to do that. So, even if they did have that it was all just the same guys with the same looks doing the same things, they still have to have that narrative be dynamic in that case. And so they made the choice to, like, let's just try and make it as as dynamic as we can. And I haven't played it yet because I just got my PS4 a couple of weeks ago and haven't borrowed your copy of it yet, Alan, to play. But I'm definitely looking forward to try it. And that certainly, it seems like that aspect of it has gotten a lot of buzz. There's a good article from Ken Levine, the creative director on BioShock and BioShock Infinite, talking about it, which we should probably link in the show notes. I'll paste it in somewhere, but he raises some of those same issues of like, it's a really interesting, trying to build narrative in the same way that people are building some kinds of narrative-less content right now, and they're trying to do the same narrative. It sounds like the stuff that he's working on next kind of falls into that same vein. He's got to talk about, which I haven't actually watched yet. I've just read sort of some of the reactions to it, but talking about, narrative as kind of these building blocks that you put together in the same way that you put together building blocks for building blocks of content for levels or something like that. Right. Like how can you kind of make narrative the same way? And there's definitely some interesting stuff happening in that space right now.
Yeah, I'm definitely excited to see where the longer term of that goes, because, even going anything, the level is something that feels external in a different way than the sort of characters and the items and the objects within it. So it's definitely fun to be able to get going back to Diablo, when you would come across items and you would pick up pretty quickly that they randomly generated, like you pick up Amazon javelins, and then you're like, oh, okay. And then you're like, oh, Amazon javelins of the whale, and then scintillating Amazon javelins of the whale. And like, it's ridiculous that anyone would ever create an item and call it that. But, that's just in this generated world with generated items, it feels like you're discovering these objects that no one has ever kind of seen before, or at least feel unique or interesting. There's, so many different combinations. One last thing I wanted to talk about, or at least give Nigel an opportunity to share anything if there's any interesting stories there, is that a lot of people don't realize that AAA games often have generated content in the way that, like, content is procedurally generated, but then baked into the game. As static assets or buildings or maybe some animation that they can't do in real time. So they simulate a fire and then they actually like capture that and then they load it into the game and then it gets played back as animation. Was there any sort of interesting circumstances that you're working on, anything like that?
I think the most obvious one, like I haven't dealt with a huge number of games that have had any significant procedural content, them with the exception of for Prototype, there was a large amount of procedural generation of content for the cities. And I think that's pretty standard for any game that's set in a city these days. It's not going to be like an artist sitting down and modeling a whole building and then moving on to the next building and modeling it, that it will almost always be that the artists build a couple of building block pieces of the level and then basically there's some kind of procedural generation system for laying out the buildings sort of in an area, right? That you'll just say, this area on the ground is the footprint of these buildings. Here is some parameters for the buildings. And this isn't even like a runtime thing. This is just offline in a tool in Maya. But you set the parameters and then you say go, and it builds you a city block using the styles that you've given it. And then maybe, a few locations that are supposed to be recognizable are modeled by hand, but the bulk of the city isn't. And we use that on definitely on the second Prototype game, I think less so on the first Prototype game. And I know that that the Assassin's Creed guys use that. They've got a video somewhere where there's some people sort of talking about their technology for that and showing off their city building tool. It's the same idea. It's just sort of paint where buildings are going to go onto the ground, and then the buildings get stitched together out of a library of pieces that you've got. And that, I think that's the most common kind of use of procedurally generated content in AAA games, is using it to just deal with some of the tremendous crushing amount of art content that you need to make. I don't know that we ever generated any any like procedural texture maps on any significant scale, but certainly there's, you know, there's lots of like grass and you know, smoke and stuff like that, textures that you can very easily generate using the procedural generation tools in like Photoshop or something like that, right? Where you just say, I want, here's some parameters for the general sort of thing I want, give me some of that and make a bunch of different variations of it using those tools. But that tends to be more the way it gets done on the high end of things, is that you generate content that's going to be baked into things rather than that you're generating lots of stuff on the fly.
A smaller example of this that I've experimented a little bit with, and my roommate Matt Thorsten, who made Towerfall, does, is when he creates levels, because he handcrafts all his levels, but he uses an auto tiler, or like to tile the levels automatically for him, and then after the tiles have been done through code, he'll go in and tweak it, be like, oh, I don't like how this one was generated, so I'm gonna change this tile and place this one here instead, and he'll kind of tweak how it looks afterwards, but the first sort of pass is done procedurally, and that's a much smaller example, but also sort of similar.
And definitely you need to do that if you're doing something like what Prototype does with New York, or what Assassin's Creed Unity is doing with Paris. Is you're not going to find a procedural content generator that's going to happen to put Notre Dame Cathedral on the right place in Ile de la Cité. Like, you gotta generate, like, okay, yeah, most people are not going to know Paris well enough to know, like, hey, the building on that corner is 4 stories in the real Paris, but it's only 3 stories in this Paris. Like, you know, people aren't going to get that that crazy about things, but you've got to put the things that are unique to that city if you're trying to generate a real city. Or even if you're not trying to generate a real city, there's going to be gameplay significant locations that you're going to want to fully model the interiors of, and you're going to have important places, and you don't necessarily want the procedural content generator just be allowed to go nuts with that. But yeah, you generate a bunch of stuff randomly, and then you go back and put in the areas that are specific to either getting your visual look or achieving your gameplay goals that you're going to build manually. And it would be terrifying to imagine how big the already huge art team for something like Assassin's Creed would need to be if someone just needed to sit and build every single building in that city by hand, right?
Yeah, that would be crazy.
Even Desert Golf did that, right? Like, the reason it has thousands of levels is because he generated this thing that just like spit out all these levels, and then he went through them and he would make little changes to them and like add a cactus halfway through and stuff like that. Like, but like,
I'm curious if did he add the cactuses by himself, or is that part of the random seed or part of the random generation?
I got the impression that he added them manually, but I'm actually not 100% sure.
Okay.
I got the impression that in the early days of the game that he hadn't actually played or even like done most of the levels. It's just like generate them all, and then he's kind of playing along. He would play a few of them, but like, and then occasionally be like, oh, let's kind of muck with this one. And like, but the supposedly final level that is supposed to be impossible, but some crazy people sometimes are able to beat it anyway, that was mostly just generated, apparently. And he's like, oh, okay, well, it's impossible to get past this, so this is the end of the game, which is awesome. Cool. Well, thanks for joining us, Noel. How can people find out about what you're up to online?
So they can follow me on Twitter, which is where I kind of keep updated on most stuff, which is just NoelFB, or I guess my website, which is noelberry.ca.
Awesome. Okay. Well, thanks everybody for listening. We always want to know what you think. We've been getting some great feedback over the last couple weeks. So keep it up. If you have particular thoughts or topics or guests that you'd like us to have on the show, definitely drop us an email. You can email hello@upup.fm or rate the show on the iTunes store. And see you next week. Have you had a chance to play any games over the break?
Not a ton. I think the thing I've been playing the most, actually kind of leading up to the break and stuff, was I've been playing a lot of Smash Bros.
Oh, yeah. You have a Wii U. Nigel, you should pick that up also. I know you're not as
we have it. The kids have been playing it. I haven't played it much myself. I find Smash Bros. Extremely confusing. Like, I never entirely understand like what's going on or whether I'm winning or losing or anything. It's it's a game that requires, and I'm sure I could get it. Like, other fighting games I played have seemed that way initially to me at first, and then eventually I've gotten the hang of it. But I've played as much Smash Brothers as I did like play Street Fighter before it started making sense to me, and it still hasn't started making sense to me. So, but the kids love it, or at least yell a lot while they're playing it, which I think is more or less the same thing.
This is the first Smash Bros. That I've really gotten into. I mean, I played the 64 one as a kid a lot and stuff like that, but this is the first one that I really been playing a ton. And it did take a while for me to kind of fully understand it. And I had help from friends explaining, like, well, when this happens, you want to do this and stuff like that. But yeah, it definitely took time and it's confusing. And yeah,
I find the phenomena really interesting because of the incredible range from people who are playing it, like the kids that play it, like they enjoy it because it's chaotic and lots of stuff is going on, but it's not really clear how much you're sucking if you're losing, and it can be fairly noob friendly to just be able to do stuff on screen and make stuff happen, all the way down to the like super super serious tournament players who will just be like, I can't believe you didn't block that thing in this crazy way when there's on this level, or like they ban all the levels except the one that's just like flat and boring, Final Destination I think is was called, and things like that, and just this incredibly wide, or they'll be like, I can't believe you play with items, that's like what a noob, and like to me that's what Smash Brothers, like there's these crazy items and you don't even understand what they're going to do and they screw up the game and make it kind of annoying, like that's just sort of the way the game is in my mind, having played mostly with newbies. But I imagine if your roommates are game developers and game people, that the average Smash Brothers skill in the house might be fairly high.
Yeah, Matt and Chevy have gotten really into it too, and they're getting into some pretty serious stuff with it. But it's a lot of fun. I really like that wide breadth of different kind of gameplay that you can do with different people who are not very skilled at it or who have not even played games very much, all the way to those very professional people who spend like hundreds and hundreds of hours perfecting that. It's really cool to see that in a game.
So you finally got a PS4, Nigel. So you haven't been playing Smash Bros. What do you select as your first game to dig into?
I start off with Assassin's Creed Unity, because that was sort of the next gen game that I was the most interested in.
Despite all of the horrible stories.
Despite all the problems. And you know what? I ended up having to play a bunch of it unpatched because PSN was down for the first 4 days I had. And it was like, it was twitchy, but I think it's one of those things of it. It seems like it got a worse reputation than I think it totally deserved, just because it was twitchy and glitchy enough that people noticed. And it's like, yeah, okay, there's the occasional thing here. I haven't gotten any of the really crazy bugs, like the people's faces disappearing and stuff like that. And now I'm playing the patch version, so probably I won't get any of those anymore. But yeah, so I played a fair bit of that. I think I'm like 2/3 or more of the way through the main story. Surprisingly, the other thing that I've been playing a fair bit of is Last of Us Remastered, which I didn't really expect to care much about. I got it basically because it seemed to be impossible to purchase a PS4 without getting it, as far as I could tell, because all of the bundles seem to include it. And I wanted to advance a little bit because I was in Calgary this week. Me and another guy I used to work with at Radical do a course there on game development as part of the Comp Sci program at the University of Calgary. And so we go and do a week of lectures at the beginning of January every year for that. And that was one of the games that we want to talk about. Like, we always talk about some games and play through a few things and sort of talk a bit about what's going on in them. And we wanted to use that one, and so I wanted to play a little bit in it, so I unlocked some of it. And I was actually having a surprising amount of fun replaying it, which usually I'm not a big person for replaying single player games, but it'd been long enough since I played it originally, and it's a good enough game that that I've been quite enjoying that. So those are the two that I've been playing the most. And then the kids got the new Little Big Planet, and so we've been playing a little bit of that, and we got Plants vs. Zombies Garden Warfare, which I'd played a fair bit on the Xbox 360, but the PS4 actually has split-screen multiplayer, so you can play co-op with someone else in the living room. And so I've been playing a fair bit of that as well.
And finally, my, like, whatever it is, 60 hours into Dragon Age Inquisition that I believe I'm at the end of the game. But I'm definitely feeling a little fatigue. It's good. There's a lot of good things about it, but it's also just so long that there's sections of it that necessarily just feel like fetch quests, like go kill 18 rabbits in the forest because we need whatever to heal whatever. It's getting a little thin. So, but I think I'm going to
Assassin's Creed Unity has some of those too. Like the game seems to be shorter than most of the other games in terms of the main story, and it's got way more side stuff, and there's some really good stuff in the side stuff, but it's really difficult to tell what it is. Like, I'm having more difficulty with that than I have with previous iterations, because previous times a lot of it was sort of telegraphed, right? Is they'd have different styles of missions, and once you sort of learned which styles of missions you liked, then you knew, okay, well, I'm going to do these missions, like, you know, something like Black Flag, I think we talked about before, right? Like, I did the first Diving Bell mission, and I was like, this is dumb. I'm not going to play any more of these. Whereas Assassin's Creed Unity, because it doesn't have that huge variety of different stuff, and the mission types aren't really telegraphed, you can't always tell whether or not a side mission is going to be something that you like until you've played it once, which is kind of annoying, because there is some of those just, like, irritating, like, okay, walk to this location and kill this guy, and okay. And then there's some that actually have a really interesting, like, oh, okay, you gotta infiltrate this interesting environment, and there's, like, multi-stage, like, you gotta find this guy and get the thing from him, and then you gotta find this other guy, and they're all well-defended, and you gotta tail one of the guys and pickpocket him on the street during one of the legs of it. But, yeah, you never know until you try the side missions which category it's gonna be into. I've been finding that aspect of it kind of frustrating.
I've been noticing my own of the exact same thing, like some side quests are fun and some aren't, and trying to figure out if I'm going to enjoy one or not. And for whatever reason, I found that I'm much more patient with needing to go take out some guy who's like some sort of fugitive or capture someone or something like that. Like, if my target is an NPC, then I'll happily go and track them down and take them out. But if my target is like an object, then I find that really tedious. Like, all right, I'm trekking through the hinterlands again because I need to get these shards that are everywhere, it just doesn't nearly feel as fun, even though it's effectively the same thing. It's just like a bunch of walking, and then you press some buttons when you get there, but it feels like I'm accomplishing more, or, you know, I guess there's like a non-zero chance that I'll successfully, like, capture this apostate mage than if I want to pick up the shard. Like, I'm going to eventually pick up the shard. It's just spend enough time to get to it and climb up on this weird thing, and of course, it's like platforming in an RPG, which is always always a bad sign.